Everyone, and welcome to episode 23 of the Zoology Ramblings podcast with me, Roby Watkinson, and my fantastic collaborator.
Hello, it's me, Emma.
That was far too much of a pause. Sorry, we record these on Zoom, so there's always going to be a lag. I was just gesturing at the screen, and I realised no one on the internet can see me doing that.
I feel like we've progressed and digressed, if that's a word, at the same time.
Yeah.
So we started off on Skype. And that was
fun,
trying to record.
That was all right, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually that was okay recording audio on there. And then now in theory we have better microphones, but we're still on different ends of the planet, so it comes with its technical challenges.
Although rather excitingly, we might be, well, we almost certainly will be on the same end of the planet quite soon, which will be exciting.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. And in fact, the event where we're going to be together, we should probably do a podcast about it, shouldn't we?
Absolutely. I was thinking that might be one of our deep dives, actually. That whole topic of conversation could be a deep dive.
Ooh. Speaking of, thank you for reminding me, deep dive. So I know it seems like we change our format every episode.
We do.
Yeah. And I think that keeps us, you know, keeps us limber. But this episode, we're going to stick to the classic species of the week. Local conservation story and then a global conservation story. But then next episode, we're going to change it a little bit. We're still going to have the species of the week because you guys on the internet have been really, really lovely and keep bombarding us over social media with cool and interesting animals and species to showcase. So we're going to keep doing that. But for the rest of it, we will, or for the rest of every other episode, we'll do a bit more of a deep dive into sort of a conservation topic. So we did some ones earlier on badger culling and canned hunting, and we want to sort of get into a bit of depth with some of these issues a bit more.
And I feel like we've lost a bit of that since kind of the biome project is in limbo at the moment a little bit, as we're figuring out how we create new content and how we get things out there with that. And that was kind of our vibe on that podcast, if you listen to us on there. So we tended to pick a topic and, as we do best, ramble incessantly for several hours.
But in depth.
Yeah, so it'd be nice to give some topics some depth that they deserve, really, when they're as complicated as some of the things we'll be exploring.
Yes. So that's what we're going to try. Any updates in your life, Emma, before we get into the bulk of the podcast? What have you been up to?
Ooh. I feel like I've been up to various bits and bobs. As I've said in previous episodes, I am working at Avon Wildlife Trust, which is very cool, very awesome. I work with some amazing people and get to meet incredible community members and individuals doing great things out for nature in their local garden or local street. So I'm at the very hyper-local level here in the UK, and particular highlight for me recently is I attended something called the Funeral for Nature in Bath.
Right.
And
I saw it on your social media. It looked a bit like The Handmaid's Tale.
I haven't watched that, but from what I've seen, yes. It was really, really somber, and it's not like any other protest or march that I've ever been to, and it wasn't meant to be. It was meant to be a procession mimicking a funeral for nature. So they had these pallbearers dressed in kind of these cool green dark shades with top hats, and they were carrying this open casket to depict Mother Nature. So it was this, I guess, a mold of a woman with this hair kind of flowing, and there was all moss growing around her. It was amazing. And then behind that you had the Red Rebels, who, if you don't know who they are, look them up and you won't forget them. They are famous for their, I don't know what you call it, kind of our activism performance, I guess. So they do everything silently. They do kind of dances and walks and are very purposeful in all their movements. And they dress in red, long red robes, and they paint their faces white, kind of like the, is it geisha? Is that how you pronounce it in
Japan?
Yeah. See, I get a similar vibe to the geisha. And this time it was perhaps the biggest gathering of Red Rebels that I've ever seen anywhere. I don't know if it was ever, but there were hundreds of them from all over the UK, from all over Europe. So you had the casket and then all these red rebels, and then behind them you had hundreds of mourners dressed in black, so as if they were attending a funeral. And that was led by Chris Packham and his stepdaughter Megan McCubbin. And they had these amazing hats, kind of just decorated with skulls and animals, but there was no singing, there was no chanting, there were no banners, there were just these really slow, somber, eerie drums and this procession walking through Bath. Yeah, it was amazing.
That's incredible. And the Red Rebels, are they an environmental activism group, or do they do other protests as well?
I think predominantly environmental. They've been affiliated with XR, that's Extinction Rebellion, quite a lot. Mm-hmm. But they tend to just be there. They're not kind of...
just there.
They're just silently there having a big impact. And
yeah, that's quite powerful.
There was this specific bit in Bath where it forms a circle. It's called the Circus. And the drums were just echoing off all the buildings because it was in a circle. And then the Red Rebels kind of... I was in the middle with my partner, and then we just kind of got surrounded by Red Rebels and then surrounded by the mourners and the drums. And it was... yeah. And then we found ashy mining bees in the middle, and we were really happy.
You found what, sorry?
Ashy mining bees. They're a type of solitary...
ashy mining bees?
They're a solitary bee. They're black and white. And there was just loads of them in nests. And so we were kind of crouched on the floor looking at them.
A little bit of nature that hasn't quite yet passed away. That's incredible.
Yeah, you would have loved
it. Did you find it moving and powerful?
Very moving. I think anyone who was there would have found it very, very moving. I mean, I was there and had goosebumps kind of when you could hear the drums. It was...
yeah.
It really had a very moving effect. I think it was very, very well done, that kind of raising awareness of this is a mock funeral now, but it's not unlikely that this could be a real funeral in the very foreseeable future. And for some species, it already is.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, some species that we've covered on the podcast, you know, the vaquita, the Javan and Sumatran rhinos, you know, we've talked about a lot of endangered species. And I was thinking, actually, as I was scrolling through the podcast recently, I was like, oh, some of these could just be a eulogy for some of these things.
Absolutely.
But it's incredible to see the mobilization that can happen when people put their mind to it.
Definitely. Yeah, and incredible. I feel like from funeral to one of the most biodiverse places on the planet, do you want to give an overview of what you were doing?
I was, I don't know if it was at the same time as you were at the funeral at nature, but I was having a romp about in northern Botswana, which was lovely. I've completely fallen in love with Botswana. Anyone who knows me well knows that I'm already madly in love with Zambia and Malawi. truly madly deeply, and I can now add Botswana to the list. The people are just the most delightful and warm, charming and kind people, and the scenery and the wildlife, it was just it was amazing. So maybe this is a, you know, the funeral is a warning of what is to come, and maybe what I was seeing is a reminder of what we still have and what there is still left to fight for. And I'll talk a bit about some parts of the Okavango we were in the next episode when we talk about community-based conservation, one of our deep dives. But it was, you know, what was really nice for me, I mean, as someone who's been in now South Africa for about a year and a half, there were no fences.
Really?
It was really nice. And yeah, and I know that the South African wildlife economy and, you know, built around fences and all the fun and, you know, pros and cons to fencing. Maybe we could do a deep dive on fencing one day.
We definitely could.
It was so lovely, just no fences and just free movement of wildlife, and you know, the conservationist in me was just like, yeah. And my family were like, what do you mean, yeah? And I'm like, no, there's no fences, you don't understand.
I feel like it's probably hard to pick one moment, but do you have a highlight from Okavango? I've heard several, which I'm very jealous about.
Do you know, in the interests of in the interest of balance, it's got to be the Bat Hawk. Have we talked about the Bat Hawk on Swirly Ramblings? I feel like we have.
We probably have, but remind people of where that came from, because that's another little thing that we both obsessed over.
So there's a really lovely author called Simon Barnes who wrote a really lovely book about the Luangwa Valley, where Emma and I have both been, and, you know, certainly to me, I think it's the most beautiful place on earth, matched now by Okavango in my book. And he does this really beautiful, it's almost like an ode to the Bat Hawk, you know. And the Bat Hawk is in itself a weird looking thing. It's like if a falcon and a swift had babies. And, you know, they sort of drunkenly bumped into each other outside the pub one night. And it wasn't, you know, planned. And so it's a very weirdly proportioned bird. It's called a bat hawk. And it's essentially a nocturnal, a crepuscular raptor that eats bats. And it's bonkers. Like, no one knows anything about it. Look at their Wikipedia article. It's got just like two scrolls long. There's barely any science done on them, barely any research. And they're one of those species where you open a bird book and you think, oh, we won't see that.
Because didn't your lecturers tell you you wouldn't see one?
Yes, and I work at the FITS, which is the Africa's premier ornithological gang. And they were like, nah, you'll never see one. And we saw three. So, yeah, that was Bat Hawk for me. It was just, yeah. I actually wrote a poem about Bat Hawks a few years ago.
Maybe you should share that with the very blurry picture of the Bat Hawk very far away.
Well, here, you know, maybe one day. But that's my news. Shall we march on with our species of the week? And yes. would you like to go first?
Yes, sounds good. So, like Roby mentioned, we are constantly given loads and loads of suggestions by people of species of the week. So apologies if we don't get to all your suggestions, but we do try and take them on board because they're really, really great. So this one was a suggestion from someone who reached out on Instagram, so thank you. And they suggested the Huatzin.
Ah, the Huatzin. That means that all of our new species of the week for this episode, including mine, are from South America.
Really?
Yeah, look at that.
I love that we don't plan these things and they just work
so
out.
So unplanned.
We are the most ad hoc podcast ever, so thank you for sticking with all our randomness.
Amazing we're still on air.
Yeah. But I think part of the reason why the Huatzin in particular stood out in the list of species that this person suggested on Instagram is just because they're so weird. So they are a bird. And no, okay, I said that in a really weird... So
thank you for clarifying.
They're a bird, but they have a lot of weird features that kind of almost make them seem non-avian. Mm. So they are kind of found, yeah, mainly Amazon jungle is a big hotspot of theirs. Mm. When I was going to say working, but you know, you never get paid in this sector. So when I was volunteering in Peru, that was when I was doing research on macaws in the middle of the Amazon rainforest.
Oh, yes, yes.
They did have huatzins there, but I never managed to see one. So we went on a big, big hike and adventure looking for them, but we didn't see them. And you can often find them kind of on low branches, kind of crouching near rivers. They have a really weird call as well. I can't quite remember what they sound like. But one of the things that is unusual about them is so their young have these little claws coming out of their wings. So that's something that dates back quite prematurely in sort of the split of birds. I think, trying to think dating back wise, let me just find the number one sec.
I mean, Huatzins are an old group, or at least the Huatzin is the most recent representative of that lineage.
I think it was about 65 million years ago is when they split off from the rest of the avian tree.
So that's before the extinction of the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Nope, sorry, I'm wrong. Just after the extinction of the dinosaurs.
So they are very, very premature is the wrong word.
Premature. Basal.
Basal, that's the word I'm looking for.
Basal.
Thank you.
We don't say primitive anymore.
Basal. Okay. Yeah. And I saw this funny thing the other day where if dinosaurs were to be alive today and be able to see their descendants, I feel like Huatzins would be something they'd be proud of. Whereas if they look at a chicken, they go, what the fuck are we doing here? How did we get from dinosaurs to chickens?
I think so.
So yeah, they have these... Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, so weirdly, there's been a new, literally it was beginning of the month, a massive new study looking at the evolutionary relationships of birds. And it's completely revised basically everything we think. And they've grouped now the Hoatzin in a massive super clade with other things, including pelicans, penguins, albatrosses, hummingbirds, and swifts. And they've called it Elementaves, which is fun, because they've diversified into both aquatic, terrestrial, and aerial niches.
Interesting.
But, I mean, that's just bonk. I mean, birds is... The bird evolutionary shit is crazy.
I feel like even before that study, the where you fit Hoatzins into kind of other taxonomic groups was always very blurry. So maybe this has cleared up a bit. I think the last study I saw was that they were closely related to like cranes and things like that. I don't know if that would come under the same grouping as pelicans.
Blimey. Well, this new study has just completely rewritten the whole thing, and I haven't read it yet, so I don't know where everything stands.
And I think originally people were trying to trace the Hoatzin based on other traits, and we now know that's not a good way to do things. But a lot of people were looking at those claws that the little ones have, because that is so unusual, and they were trying to date that back and see what other species do have those claws.
Oh, I see. So they were going on a morphological, anatomical basis.
Yeah, because no other birds really have that feature, so that was kind of a dead end. And also...
Yes, you can't really compare it to anything else if it's the only one.
Yeah. And also, another completely bizarre thing about the Hoatzin is its stomach. Because it's their stomach is kind of, and their digestive system is sort of described more as bovine than avian. So they're the only bird in the world that eats leaves. All they eat is leaves, which isn't very nutritious, and it's hard to digest. So because of
that, the only bird in the world,
apparently, to just like to be exclusively, what's the word, folivorous.
Yeah, folivorous.
Yeah, and because that's hard to digest, as we know from other animals that just eat leaves, they have this multi-chambered digestive tract with lots of little stomachs. And then kind of in a similar way to cattle, as an example, they then kind of break that down, ferment it, and I think produce methane in the process in a similar way to cattle. So they're these bizarre, clawed, kind of weird cow-stomached birds.
What on earth is going on with these buggers?
Yeah, I don't know. They're really weird, and that's why I like them.
Nice. Well, that's crazy. Well, I'm gonna do a bit more research on the Hoatzin. It's a bit, maybe you've got unfinished business with the Hoatzin. Maybe we need to go on an adventure and find some.
I think we do. We have a lot of unfinished businesses with animals, don't we?
We do. But I think that keeps life interesting. It gives you something to look forward to down the line.
So does your animal have weird stomachs and features?
I don't know if it's got weird stomachs. So I'm cheating. I've got two.
Ooh.
But I thought I'd group them because even though one's a deer and one's a snake, they're both South American, and it's a similar case. So yeah, it seems this year South America has been a hotbed for new sort of weird things going on. And this is actually two new species. So I thought I would, you know, do them the honour of making them species of the week, considering they're new to science. I doubt I'll get a thank you, but you know, here's to hoping. But as so often happens in phylogeny and taxonomy, none of these discoveries were made by like intrepid explorers journeying into undocumented lands and finding completely new animals. It's knowledge that has come about through better scrutiny of genetics and museum specimens, understanding the variations within populations, and assigning species based on what we already know. And I picked these two because they very neatly illustrate the concept of cryptic species, the process of allopatric speciation. So I'm going to begin with the rather enchantingly named Pudella Carliae. which is the Peruvian youngest. Well, it is the Peruvian youngest poodoo, Emma. The Peruvian youngest poodoo, you ask.
The youngest if poodoo. That,
youngas.
Youngas. I was like, how youngest Peruvian compared youngas. To who?
And if that didn't clear it up at all, it is a deer. It is the, it has, well, it holds the delightful distinction of the first living deer species to be described in the 21st century and the first in the Americas for over 60 years. So, you know, well done.
So well is done this, to the poodoo. Does that mean that it in a similar way to the Huatzin, that it is a more of a, like a basal clade in term of basal lineage of deer, if it was like the first living deer species to be described, or is that just people finding it?
No, that's people finding it.
Okay.
In fact, we already knew it was there. We've only now just described it as a new species. So poodoos are a pair of deer species from South America, and we've known they exist, but they're poodoos, you know, native to the Andes. And there used to be two species, the northern poodoo, which was Poodoo Mephistopheles, which I think is a biblical term for the devil. So I don't know what that deer did wrong. And then the southern poodoo, which is Poodoo Pooda.
Great name.
Isn't that? They've got brilliant names. The devil poodoo and Poodoo Pooda. And they held the titles of smallest and second smallest deers in the world. So they're teeny little things. For international listeners who don't have, who can't Google it at the moment, a poodoo looks a bit like a furry monk jack. If you're from sort of Eurasia, or and if you're from Africa, maybe like a furry duiker.
Oh, they're really sweet. I've just looked.
Aren't they sweet?
They're really sweet. And the little ones have almost kind of fallow deer marking in terms of those white spots on the young ones.
Ah. Well, a new study by researchers Javier Barillo, Alicia... excuse me if I'm pronouncing your name wrong, if you're listening. Elisa E. Gutierrez and Guillermo de Elia, published in the Journal of Mammalogy, has found that the northern poodoo is actually split into two geographically distinct populations, separated by this thing called the Huancabamba Depression, which I think is
great name.
A big
You're picking your great names here for species and locations.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to note for the record that I didn't name the Huancabamba Depression or the poodoos. So you got the northern species, the southern species. The northern species is divided in two. They looked at the genetics of the southern population of the northern species, just to make that really clear for everyone. And they found that it was not only different enough from the rest of the northern population to be considered distinct, but not just a subspecies, but a species. And they also find that this new species, and indeed the old northern species, are not particularly related to the southern poodoo. And so they've moved it into a new genus, Poodella. For the two more northerly forms.
I feel like my head's exploding a bit there with with how that fits in. But it is quite unusual for it to be classed as an entirely new species. That isn't something that happens very often, is it?
No. And even more unusual to move it to a different genus. Okay, so this is the quick version. Two species, north and south. North species divided in two. And the bottom of the north species is a new species. And because of that, they realised actually both northern species are a new genus to the southern one.
Right, okay.
Bam.
Yeah.
Science. And rather lovelily, Poodella carliae is named for another biologist, Carla Gozzolo, who saved the life of one of the lead authors. What isn't that nice? Isn't that a nice way to be rewarded?
That's so nice. Oh, you'd hope you'd be acknowledged if you
would.
Save someone's life.
And the reason I picked this is because Poodella carliae is a really good example of two cool concepts in biology and ecology. So cryptic species and allopatric speciation. Cryptic species refers to a species that is outwardly indistinguishable from another closely related species. And we can only tell the differences by looking at genetics. And that the natural world is full of cryptic species. Do you remember in undergrad we had those butterflies, which were all different species, even though they looked identical?
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots and lots of insects.
It's a really interesting realm.
Yes. And, you know, talk about splitting hairs. But it's mainly because we called species different species based just on looks, because we didn't have any genetics. And so, you know, as genetics develops and we test more things, we can sort of expect more and more cryptic species to be revealed. And allopatric speciation is an interesting process by which cryptic species arise. So in allopatric speciation, you have a population which is divided in two by a geographic barrier, which prevents gene flow. And the two species, the two populations develop into two different species. So it seems in the Pudela's case, you had ancestral Pudela split by the development of the Huancabamba depression. Or maybe, you know, some individuals cross the depression and the rest stay behind. Population divided in two, reproductively isolated, new species. Which I think is a lovely idea.
It really is. And I was just, you mentioning some examples we brought up when we were at university. Wasn't there that lovely example of, it was a type of bird that, because of that idea of allopatric speciation separated by physical barriers, that their bird song changed so significantly that by the time the groups kind of were connected together at the end, they weren't able to recognize each other's calls?
Yes, wasn't that in the Himalayas? Didn't one group go sort of right and one group go left to get round the Himalayas, and by the time they'd met again at the top, they were different species, which is,
yeah, I
love
that.
Really lovely. That's cool. Biology's full of weird shit. So that's Pudela Carlier. We welcome you to, you know, the world. I mean, they were always in it. They were here already. We just only just noticed them. And now the second discovery is from the Amazon, and it's a new species of anaconda.
Yes, I love that.
Yeah, I'm going to do anaconda in 9 minutes.
Cool.
Okay. So just for international listeners, we are poor uni students. Well, poor ex-uni students. So we're both just conservationists now. Anyway, we haven't got Zoom. We haven't got the proper Zoom. So I'm going to do a new species of anaconda in 8 minutes, 55 seconds. Okay, here we go. Let's give a warm welcome to Eunectes acayima, the northern green anaconda.
Woo,
announced
welcome.
In a new paper. Woo. By Professor Jesus Rivas from New Mexico Highlands University and 14 other authors. As in the case of the Pudus, it was previously considered to be a northern population of the green anaconda, Eunectes marinus, the biggest snake in the world. Not the longest, but the heaviest. It's now been split on the basis of genetic evidence. Again, cryptic species, no morphological difference between the green and the northern green. Also might be a case of allopatric speciation. Populations are sort of somewhat separated by this Valpez arch, sort of hydrological basin. But anyway, I digress. I've only got 8 minutes. Sorry, I'm pissing myself here. So anacondas in Eunectes genus, largest and heaviest snake in the world. Green anacondas reliably documented 6.5 meters long and
That's
500
ridiculous.
Kilograms, which is outrageous.
I'm not very...
Oh, can I swear on
I'm
this
not
one?
One to be afraid of big or little things, but I think if I encountered that, I would, yeah, be concerned
we
that I wouldn't
get...
want to get too close.
We would get stomped. So this new designation is the result of 20 years of genetic data from looking at all four anaconda species and essentially recognised a really deep divergence, and so new subspecies. Lovelily, the specific name acayima honours the traditional name for the snake by the local Carib people, and several of the specimens were found by researchers working in Ecuador with the indigenous Huarani people, and I apologise if I didn't pronounce that correctly. A leader of their people who helped on the expedition, Penti Baihua, and they consider the anaconda sacred, were acknowledged as co-authors in the discovery paper.
That's really
so
nice.
So I think that's nice.
I think that needs to happen more.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could do a whole podcast just going through the diversity of life and renaming things to honour the people who actually participated in their discovery and protection. Unfortunately, the erection of Eunectes acayima as a distinct species is not completely accepted. It's under dispute. Two disputes have been published. One is criticising the validity of the name Eunectes acayima on procedural grounds and suggests that it violates the International Code of Zoological Nomenclature, that one thing we cannot violate. They're saying that the oldest available name for like the northern anacondas is Eunectes gigas from 1801, and therefore by the rules of the ICZN it should take precedence. But, you know, talk about splitting hairs. But then, you know, we can't violate the IUCN because otherwise everything crumbles. Which would be a shame, because Akiyama really honours the people who live with that animal. So we'll see how that pans out. And then the second study questions the validity of the genetic markers that were used. So the basis of splitting this new species is a 5.5% difference in mitochondrial DNA. But nuclear DNA failed to recover any difference. And so, you know, it's really complex. And you can tell I love taxonomy and phylogenetic quagmires. And we have now taken the world's largest snake and dumped it into the middle of that quagmire. And hopefully someone will come along and sort it out. But anyway, I thought worth mentioning Pudela Carlier and Eunectes Akiyama, the Peruvian youngest pudu and the northern green anaconda, to welcome to the world.
I feel like they were such you animals in the best way possible. This is your kind of thing. I can see you finding this article or wherever you found this and said, oh, we've got a taxonomic debate to dive into here. And no one else probably has even heard of the species, let alone the divisions of species that are going on. So I'm glad you're enlightening everyone.
I promise I am done with taxonomy for this podcast episode. And I'll have you know, with 4 minutes and 43 seconds to go. So perhaps now we can take a short break, as Emma and I have waffled on for far too long, as ever, and we now need to change our Zoom call. So we will see you, dear listener. Well, see you, hear you. No, we won't hear you. You will hear us. I don't know what I'm saying. It's been a long Monday and Tuesday, okay? It's been a long start to the week. Anyway, we will see you after the break. So, welcome back, everyone. I hope you enjoyed your break. You know, doing whatever it is you did. I got peanuts, is what I did. Emma sorted out the technology, because that's the kind of team we are.
Yeah, apologies. So, I feel like this podcast episode is really chaotic. But we're sorting it all out so that next time it'll be nice and smooth and there won't be any of this.
So why don't we jump back in? What is your local conservation story or polemic or your local thing?
I feel like my local thing, some of you might have heard me go on a, what I like to call a diplomatic rant on Instagram. And I wanted to talk about the new badger culling policy, or as they are officially marketing it, as the bovine TB policy. But let's be real, all they're covering is badger culling. So
one of those.
Yes.
Bastard.
So
sorry. Anyway.
No, they are. When I read, so there was a consultation recently in April, and that's now come to an end. The time period for people to submit their views on this new consultation. And I read it, and I had to take about a week just to digest that what I'd read wasn't made up. And
just before you tell us about what you read, for a bit of context for international listeners, in the UK there is bovine tuberculosis, which is a cattle disease. It's in the domestic cattle population. It's very, very damaging, and people have blamed badgers, European badgers, as the vector for disease transmission. Anyway, continue. Over to you.
No, that's good, having a bit more background, I think, and also just to give you some numbers on that. So it is, well, bovine TB is a devastating disease. It's horrible for farmers. It's like you going to the doctors and getting a medical diagnosis for something really, really serious. It changes your life. It financially, physically, mentally affects you. So just to set the tone there, it's a horrible disease for farmers. And the aim always should be eradication of bovine TB. It doesn't matter what animals are involved, that's the aim. But there's quite a lot of science that says that about 94% of transmissions of bovine TB are from cattle to cattle. So most cattle are catching bovine TB, which is a respiratory infection, from other cattle. But all mammalian species can carry the disease and be vectors. And badgers are one of those species here in the UK. So it could be that a cow catches TB from a badger, but then that cow would spread the TB to all the other cows. So what really needs to happen is much more control on cattle management and practical cattle policy, looking at how we manage cattle in the UK. A big problem is we simply have too many cattle. The way we're moving cattle around the country is also a problem. That's not regulated as much as it should be. And just the intensification of the meat and dairy industry as well means we've got huge quantities of cattle kept indoors for about 6 months of the year in a very small space. So all of those factors, if we learn anything from COVID, is going to tell you that that is how infection is going to spread like wildfire. And bovine TB is mainly transmitted through, it can be direct or indirect, but direct is kind of like saliva droplets, direct contact. Think of it like COVID. And it can also be indirect, so like urine, feces, and that's when it's more of an environmental factor. So that's when something like badgers could come in if they're interacting in the same general environment as cattle. So backstory of why we need more cattle management. And then we go to the consultation, which was looking at how do we control bovine TB looking, say, to like 2030 or the next few years and decades. And
who did they consult?
Well, so it was a consultation that was led by DEFRA, which is the environment body that acts on behalf of the government here in the UK. And the consultation was open to anyone. The Badger Trust, who are kind of leading here in the UK on the badger front, wrote their own response to the consultation. The Wildlife Trust wrote their own. Yeah, all expressing their dislike and anger at what they were suggesting in this consultation, because it's going so backwards against what the government said they would do, because they have said that they're moving towards more non-lethal methods like vaccination cattle.
We should probably just very quickly say, because I don't think we've mentioned yet, the government's solution to bovine TB is at present not a cattle-based solution. It's culling of badgers. I just realised we haven't actually said that. So yeah, that's what they're doing now. Is that what they're doing now?
They are, but they said they were moving away from that. So it's really disappointing to see a few years on from the last one. I actually think this has more culling and less vaccination in than the one that was written like 4 years ago. But anyway, what they are proposing this time is what they're calling a targeted badger intervention policy. So basically what that means is that they're going to focus on culling, where there's basically in areas where there's any risk of spread of bovine TB to cattle, so in these high risk areas. They're going to cull badgers kind of intensively for a period of several years. And then after that, they're going to bring in vaccination as what they're calling an exit strategy. So after they've killed loads of badgers and done loads of killing and culling, then they're going to bring in vaccination and hope that that keeps the levels of TB down. So feel free to comment on this, Roby, but I'm going to start by saying why I think that's a bad idea.
No, go on, please.
So a lot of research has shown that culling can actually increase the spread of bovine TB rather than decreasing it. So Rosie Woodruff from the Zoological Society of London, she's brilliant. She explained it really well. So she said to imagine the control of bovine TB and culling as if it were COVID. So badgers are kind of like how we were in bubbles, so sticking to their family groups. They don't tend to mix that much unless they're breeding or maybe foraging. Occasionally they'll bump into each other, but they kind of just stick to their groups. And what they're doing with culling is that disturbs the animals. It causes them to spread out. It's called the perturbation effect. And it means that they then start mixing with a lot of other badgers, and there is more chance that they're going to catch bovine TB. So it actually increases the spread. So it's the equivalent of, say you killed 70% of the human population to try and control COVID, but then you let the 30% remaining go out on a pub crawl every night. That's what culling is. Because overall, it reduces the number of TB cases because there's less badgers, but it's never going to eradicate the disease, which is the whole point of trying to help farmers and cattle, is to actually get to the root cause and eradicate it.
I mean, it just it shows a fundamental disregard, I think, for professional scientific opinion, this policy. I mean, it's, you know, it sounds very nice. What are they calling it? A targeted badger intervention policy.
Yeah,
it sounds lovely. You can imagine it on the front of a document. Here you go. Here's the targeted badger intervention policy. But I think it really betrays a very reactive mindset. And, you know, this isn't a badger problem. This is a public health problem. And it's a cattle management problem. And I don't quite see why the badgers are being brought into it at all. As far as I'm aware, and I could be wrong about this, if anyone's listening who knows better, do correct me. As far as I'm aware, badgers are not significant, are not a more significant reservoir of bovine TB than other animals in the British countryside. Red foxes, you know, squirrels, deer in particular. So it seems odd to focus on this one species. And it seems from a public health point of view, which I think this is a public health crisis, the logical thing to do is take out the step which spreads transmissions to cattle. And so, okay, you vaccinate all your cattle. Or you vaccinate, if that's too expensive, you only vaccinate cattle in targeted areas of high risk. And then you limit the movement of those cattle from targeted areas of high risk. If there's no bovine TB in the north of England, fine, you can move your cattle about. If there's a lot of bovine TB, either in the badger population or in other wildlife vectors in, you know, the south of England, then we need really strict controls on cattle movement, and we need to be vaccinating those cattle. And it seems to me that that is a cheaper... Again, I don't know this. This is an assumption I'm making. It seems to me that would be cheaper than repeat culling every year, because that is an increasing cost every year. And it seems like that would be cheaper than the long-term effect of essentially what this policy is spreading the prevalence, the geographical distribution of bovine TB more. And the final thing I will say is I think this betrays I'm trying to figure out how I put this politely. I think this indicates that nature conservation agencies in the UK are more... I'm going to just say it. They're going to listen to the interests of farmers more than they're going to listen to the interests of conservationists. And I think the reason for that is very clear, in that farmers are really a politically engaged group, and conservationists by and large aren't. And I think farmers are very good at drumming up political support because, you know, they are a predominantly rural sector, and the ruling party, the Conservative Party, relies on predominantly... Well, not exclusively, but it does rely on predominantly rural seats. So what we're seeing is the kind of awful axis of the awful axis of politics and too much stakeholder influence. I fully believe that this bovine TB crisis is a real financial and emotional and economic strain on our farmers. And you know, my overwhelming priority is to alleviate that strain. And it seems like this policy is really actually going to hurt the farmers more than anyone. Obviously, it's going to hurt the badgers, but this is going to hurt farmers because it's not going to stop bovine TB. Indeed, it's going to spread bovine TB. So I really, and you know, farmers have been on the receiving end of poor environmental policy in Britain for far too long. And I really feel for them as well, because this is going to impact their livelihoods. Anyway,
No, absolutely. And I think it's really sad because in a lot of ways, they are being lied to and deceived, that they're using, like you said, that political spin to think that the government and this policy has their best interests at heart, when it doesn't. So it's not even that the party is putting in the best policies to help the farmers. I think one more point I'll make politically is one thing I didn't realise. So this whole culling shenanigans started under the Labour government, so it wasn't initially Conservative Party policy. So it was back in the 1980s, and the Labour government basically wanted to answer the question, does killing significant number of badgers reduce the instances of bovine TB in cattle? Big study. It was, probably if we're looking at anything like the figures we are now, which is 100 million per year on the taxpayer to control bovine TB.
Bloody
hell. So it was tens of thousands of badgers killed and millions of pounds were put into these studies. It was one of the most extensive studies that have ever taken place on bovine TB. And their conclusions were that there's no meaningful relationship between kind of culling badgers and the instances of bovine TB. And actually, they mentioned in that study that actually it could make it worse. So that was the foundation of badger culling policy. And then I can't remember who it was, but it was someone stuck their neck out and said that they had a few problems with how they'd done the results and that actually that couldn't be trusted. And if you change the parameters, culling is actually effective. And from then, it then went into Conservative Party manifesto in 2010. Based on this one person who said, no, look, these findings are flawed. And then in 2013, that's when mass culling really started. So since 2013, about 230,000 badgers have been culled. And to give you an idea of how that fits in with the whole badger population, so they reckon that if it keeps going at this rate, by the end of this year, they'll have culled half the population of British badgers. So
my God.
We're possibly looking at local extinctions of the largest carnivore that we have left in the UK.
I was going to say, the only bloody carnivore we've got left half the time.
Yeah.
I suppose in the fox.
And I think going back to a point you made, I think kind of the Holy Grail answer to all of this would be cattle vaccinations. But the problem is that they haven't invested enough in a test that can distinguish between whether the cattle have been vaccinated or whether they're positive for bovine TB. Because the vaccination is a live vaccine, they have to give them some bovine TB to protect them. There is a test. It's called the DIVA test. But it's either it's in the final stages of being rolled out or maybe is being rolled out in some areas, but definitely not the scale that we need. Because the problem with that is if you're a farmer and you try and sell your cattle to someone and it tests positive, they need to be able to believe you that the positive test is coming from vaccination rather than it having TB. So that I think that's where the loophole lies.
It seems to me that the cost of getting that process sorted, of getting access to these vaccinations, of getting a reporting system, it seems to me that the cost of establishing that system would be less than the yearly repeated cost of not just culling, but dealing with increased bovine TB. It seems to me. I don't know if that's true, but it seems to me that would be the case. And this is what really, really annoys me about nature conservation in the UK, and part of the reason why I moved overseas to continue my studies in conservation is that this is pretty emblematic of what conservation can be like in Britain, in that a problem arises and the immediate knee-jerk reaction is just bang it on the head with something. To a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Without the understanding that actually nuanced problems require nuanced issues, and is so often the case in conservation, it's not actually about the wild animals, it's about humans, it's about public health policy, and it's about the regulation of livestock. The thing that really gets me, the thing that really makes me really angry, I mean, apart from the fact that we're losing half of the remaining large carnivores that we have by the end of this year, apart from that, is that farmers haven't had it easy in the UK for decades now. Both under the EU and now outside of the EU, and under successive prime ministers, farmers have been shafted, and they will continue to be shafted under this policy. This is not good for a really valuable sector in our society. We're not food sufficient in Britain. We can't feed ourselves. We need our farmers, and they could be real assets to the conservation of our natural landscapes. They could be really at the forefront of that. And this is just, to me, I'm looking at this policy and seeing it as another way to keep farmers angry, to keep them poor, and to keep them voting for a government that, I'm getting too political for the, no, I'm not, sod it. And to keep them voting for a government that doesn't have their best interests at heart.
Yeah.
I'm just remembering, no, we can get political on this podcast. It's biome.
We can, it's ours, and we can say what we like, even if we potentially piss off some of our listeners. But I think it's really important to raise that point because it is failing people. It is failing farmers.
Mm.
And yeah, it's really disappointing because there are ways that you can work with farmers. So I think Cornwall Wildlife Trust have done an amazing job. So they decided to change all of their wording. So they don't say that they're anti-cull. They've gone down the route that they just say they're pro-vaccination of badgers. Mm-hmm. And so they went into rural communities in Cornwall saying that they were going to be vaccinating badgers, and if anyone wanted to come and learn more about the process, that they could come. And I think they had about 30, maybe more, farmers come and want to learn about the alternative to culling. So I think the cull were recruiting at the same time. So they weren't trying to dissuade people from joining the cull. They just wanted to present another option. And I think a lot of farmers, it was appealing to them because it was a non-lethal way that they felt could actually help their cattle. And so they got involved. They were helping with the vaccination. They were helping putting out peanuts and stuff in the traps. And it apparently, I know it's a smaller scale context, but they had kind of barbecues with the farmers. They received rounds of applause Brilliant. For their work and the vaccination programs. So it shows you can work with farmers on this and they can be part of the solution. And I think another thing I didn't mention about this policy, which will frustrate the hell out of you, is that where they're issuing new culling licenses, vaccination isn't a prerequisite for culling not being allowed to happen. So basically, you could have vaccination programs having happened successfully in that area for years and years and years and years, yet they could still issue cull licenses in those areas where they've been vaccinations because they said, we can't guarantee that, you know, you've deployed enough vaccinations.
And the money is getting pissed away. It's getting pissed away.
I mean, that's much money that they've put into vaccinations, which has been effective, and they could literally just go in and cull where they've just vaccinated.
And, you know, the other reason this is really pissing me off is because, you know, nature conservation in Britain and across the world, if it's going to work well, it's a multi-stakeholder process. You know, we've got to get everyone involved. And, you know, ultimately, you know, a good farming environment for farmers who want to raise, you know, healthy, high quality farming product is going to be a better ecological environment. It just is. We know this. There's so many studies now that are doing this. And what really annoys me is this is going to just drive another wedge in the polarization between, you've got farmers on one side and conservationists on the other side, which is, not good for conservation. It's not good for farmers. It's not good for society to continue to divide people. And I think, you know, I think in the long term, farmers are going to lose out. As I've said, we can't lose farmers. We need farmers. They're, you know, dedicated, brilliant people who are close to the land. And this is just going to be crap for them.
Because I really don't think it's that much of a leap to see what needs to happen here. It's the government and DEFRA need to be supporting farmers to eradicate the disease from the cattle side. So they work on cattle management, cattle vaccination, all of that. And then us as the conservation wildlife people, we can help on the badger side by vaccinating badgers, raising awareness, getting farmers involved. And then that's how we can help and work together. So the wildlifey people can go, okay, we recognise that badgers are a reservoir for TB and deer and those other species. So we can take the lead on that side. But they need to take the lead on cattle management. Because so this consultation was about 9 pages long. About 8
Can you send it to me? I'm going to read it. If you've got a copy, can you send it to me?
I will. You will be fuming.
it goes to my pile of things I need to read that have come out recently. I'm going to read the badger culling thing. I'm going to read the Cass review on gender care in the NHS. And I'm going to read that new bird paper.
I feel like the bird paper might be the only one that gives you a little bit of hope in society.
continue.
In this document, about 8 of those 9 pages, 8.5 pages, is about badger culling. And then they have a tiny little paragraph at the bottom titled cattle. Only thing that they're proposing for cattle, I'm so fuming about this, is they're going to have an interactive online map which shows farmers where more information about TB and how herds are being moved around. It's an interactive online map.
What the barreling fuck is going on in this country? I mean, and and the thing, it really, because, you know, if government did care about the welfare and the livelihoods of farmers, they would put the cattle regulations in, because ultimately cattle regulations will be better for farmers. Yeah, they might not just be able to sell cattle willy-nilly wherever they want, but in the long term, the health of their stock is getting better, the health of their herds are getting better, public faith in the quality of the meat will increase. You know, I just think, and government faith in the quality of the meat will increase, so government, you know, will have more reason to support a domestic industry. And I just think, Anyway.
I am glad you're sharing my rage, because
I'm fucking fuming.
I was so annoyed, and so many people were. I mean, people who've been vaccinating badgers for the last few years and thought that they were going to turn around and look more into non-lethal control and actually help the farmers. It was just like a big kind of stab in the back to see that they've backtracked so far from... Because I know the government are really good at going back on what they said they do, but they really were quite serious about saying that they were committed to moving away from culling. Yet here we have culling being rolled out on a larger scale than we've ever seen before. And also, another change is that the people issuing the cull licenses used to be Natural England. That has now changed.
Who at least pretend to be guided by science.
They do, and now it's going to be the Secretary of State.
Oh, God.
So, yes, keeping it all in their little bubble and making people...
Sorry,
think.
Are we suggesting that the Secretary of State has got updated population and density estimates for badgers across the entire nation? How is it? Is he going out and camera trapping?
I would love if he did. I'd have more respect for him if he did.
Is it Therese Coffey at the moment? Is it her? Oh, is it Steve Barclay?
Oh, he rings a bell.
Yeah. Mr. Barclay, get ready for a strongly worded letter.
So, yes. The only positive I can say from that is that it brought people together. A lot of people spoke out about it. And, yeah, it was nice to see them. They did try to include badger vaccination in there, but they just went about it the completely wrong way that isn't going to be helpful to badgers or farmers. So we'll try to keep you posted in future episodes what the outcome of that consultation was, but I can't imagine it being hugely positive, given that I didn't agree with any of the points that they were suggesting, bar like one or two where I was like, yeah, okay, do that a lot more and a lot bigger scale and start it now.
So will this consultation become policy? Is that...
If it goes ahead, yes.
Right, okay.
So that will be their policy on bovine TB moving forwards.
Shall we move to a more optimistic local conservation story?
Please do, because okay. I have gone down this rabbit hole for the past few weeks and I need a positive tangent.
Okay, well, it's local to Southern Africa, where I am at the minute. And I was very lucky a few weeks ago. I attended a wild track workshop at a reserve called Telperion. And wild track they're actually an American NGO run by two collaborators of mine. So we're working on a paper together at the moment on leopards, as it happens. But this workshop wasn't on leopards. And the premise of wild track is using AI and morphometric analyses of footprints for non-invasive monitoring and non-invasive conservation. So the polar opposite of the badger cull.
You couldn't be more different, really, could you?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've sort of been out in the field for the last month and a half doing various bits and bobs. So this workshop was held in the Highveld of South Africa. The Highveld is the sort of interior region of elevated land sort of around the province of Gauteng. It's got the Drakensberg and the Lowveld, Kruger to the east, the coastal plains and forests to the south, beyond Lesotho, arid Karoo to the west. And if you keep going, you get Cape Town, where I am. This workshop was my first experience of the Highveld. South African friends had extensively spoken about it, but it's a very surreal landscape. It's not savanna. It's not desert. It's not forest. It's grassland, as far as the eye can see, in little kopjes.
So no tree, not tree dominated then?
Very few trees. Just undulating, rolling plains. And it's got this sort of endemic antelope fauna. So black wildebeest, Plain Zebra, Springbok, Bontebok and Blesbok. It's a very a sort of unusual ungulate assemblage. So the workshop was hosted at a reserve there, and it was hosting discussions from conservationists all across southern Africa who were using the WildTrak technology. So what is WildTrak? So WildTrak's basic principle is that we can use non-invasive survey methods to monitor endangered species. Obviously, we need to monitor endangered species, and there are a lot of invasive ways of doing that. I mean, you know, speaking from a leopard point of view, you want to monitor leopards, you can dart them, bait them, dart them, immobilize them, put a collar on them, and that's incredibly invasive. You know, how would you feel if a strange animal pops out of a bush, tranquilizes you with a rifle? It might sound a bit flippant to us humans, but there's really serious impacts to that kind of invasive monitoring. Zoe and Skye worked on black rhinos in the Cinnamantella Intensive Protection Zone in Wangi National Park a few decades ago now. And the black rhinos there were monitored by collaring. And most females would be collared twice a year to know where they're going, because the neck expands and contracts based on condition and diet. And they found that before the collar, and the collaring was meant to help them protect them from poachers. How? No one knows. Poachers aren't going to not shoot something because it's got a collar. It's completely flawed. But anyway, they found that under natural circumstances, black rhino females would drop a calf every 3 years. Under this two-collaring immobilization program, to save them from poaching, they would drop a calf every 10 years. So invasive monitoring can affect the species that you're trying to save.
Yeah.
WildTrak is trying to solve that using footprints. The premise of WildTrak is that every animal's footprint is unique to the individual, the same as our handprints and our fingerprints. And by applying AI and morphometrics, we can determine the number of density of individuals in a population through spore sampling, footprint surveys. Spore is what we call it.
Because you were using in your master's dissertation, weren't you?
I was, for leopards, yeah. And then by applying morphometric analyses to the spore, we can determine the age, sex and weight of individuals we sampled. And we never even need to see them. Don't need to get it on a camera trap, don't need to dart it, just by footprints alone.
That's amazing. So I really didn't realize that was possible from a footprint.
It's crazy. I mean, so different species have different ecologies, which means their footprints are different. You know, some animals don't really leave footprints that much. So, you know, how would you apply this to birds? But that's the premise. So I presented my thesis work. So I'm using the FIT method to census for leopard population size and density. There was a team from the University of Joburg who were using the WildTrak method to distinguish between the prints of brown and spotted hyenas outside Gonareju National Park in Zimbabwe. There's hyena predation on livestock outside Gonareju National Park. But because both species occur, it's difficult to identify which animal is predating on the livestock.
Mm.
Spotties are active hunters, browns are scavengers, so the people often find the browns around the carcasses, but that doesn't mean the brown hyena killed it. Retaliatory killings... So identifying between the two is really important. And the sort of coolest team there, and really, really made my stuff look like the most basic application of this technology possible. The coolest team there were from Botswana. And they were looking at the application of WildTrak for anti-poaching. So this is incredible. This is really cool shit. So they were mounting cameras on drones. They then fly the drones, long-range drones, over wildlife paths. Like sometimes like 9 meters high. It's really high. They take photos. And if they find human footprints, they take photos of the footprints. And the aim is to be able to identify poachers, even if they're wearing different shoes.
I couldn't so same believe this. On two but you were telling me about this. Different I'm like, shoes. How on earth are they That's doing mad. This?
And sometimes the poachers, they put the buffalo hooves on the underside of their shoes facing backwards. So it looks like it's not a human walking forwards, it's a buffalo going in the other way. And they can tell if it's a human doing that or an actual buffalo. They can even tell, well, they haven't yet developed it to this extent, but they're hoping to even tell if the guy is holding a gun based on how he's positioning his
weight. How can they tell this from a footprint?
AI and morphometric.
Cool.
I'm not abreast on the technical details. I'm using it in my work, and Zoe and Skye are on top of the technical side of it. But it's also looking at gait, so the relationship of one print to another, not just the image of the print itself. And then the other part of the workshop was small mammal tracking. So what they're doing to train, you can't just show the photos to the algorithm and it says rhino, 2 years old, male, this heavy. You have to teach that algorithm to recognize that. So for leopards, I've been building up a database of leopards, of footprints from known animals. So I can tell the algorithm, this footprint is what it looks like if it's a male, 10 years old, weighs this much. You then take that to the field. So we were doing that for small mammals at the workshop. So we were trapping rodents and little sengis,
which
used to be called elephant shrews. Lovely. I mean, they're neither elephants nor shrews.
They look more shrew-like than elephant.
They do. They do. And so WildTrack are going to build up this library. And then the idea is you can put a track plate out, leave it overnight, get the animals to scuttle over with a little bit of, I don't know, peanut butter or something. Never have to see them, never have to catch them. You run that through the algorithm and it tells you number of species and it tells you number of individuals. Bingo. And that, small mammals, indicator species, you know, really important for the health of the ecosystem. Completely non-invasive. And it was, as someone who works on leopards where, you know, you can carpet a reserve in camera traps for, you know, months on end and get two photos which you can't run an analysis on. It was so fun to work on small mammals where you just got data, like, you know, you can catch like 50 in a night if you're lucky. It was just, oh, so much data. It was lovely.
It looks
so
amazing,
that's my local
though.
Conservation
just
story.
Seeing,
it's good fun.
Seeing that other side and I guess knowing what your research can be applied to as well, kind of the technology that you've been using and how that applies in other settings is so, so cool. I mean, the poachers thing blows my mind how that's even possible.
Crazy. And that, what I was describing, that's the end goal. They can't do all of that now, but that's what they're working towards. And yeah, really cool team from Botswana who are doing that as well. So yeah, it was brilliant. It was, and that was quite a, for me, it was quite an optimistic local story. It really gave me hope for the future of non-invasive conservation which I thought was, you know, a nice counterweight to badger culling.
Absolutely, we needed that. So maybe if we take a little break now, so you can debrief from some of the hard-hitting culling and go look up awesome WildTrack stuff that Roby has just talked about, and we will come back after a break.
Okie dokies, welcome back to the Smallish Ramblings podcast. Emma and I were just saying, as ever, we have rambled, but it's nice. I like chatting.
I love zoology ramblings, and hopefully listeners do as well.
Yes,
we're famous
we
for our rambling, so we've got to live up to the name.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe when we're together again over the coming summer, we could do one in person. I mean, I think we're fated to just never do them together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We will have to do a debrief, though, after this exciting event that Roby and I are doing together. Won't tell you too much right now, but we will do a debrief after that, because it's a lot of interesting topics.
Yes, that would be good. And that actually will be something I've never spoken about publicly before. So that'll be interesting.
Yeah, I guess we have to decide if we want to
share
that side of ourselves on zoology ramblings.
Yeah. Anyway, global stories. We are coming to the last third of the podcast. And Emma, what would you like to talk about for conservation globally?
I think you'll like this one. So a little bit of pre-context to this, which has very little to do with this story, but you'll see the link in a second. Is when Roby and I first met at university, there were a few things that initially we realised we were going to be very good friends very quickly.
Oh, yeah.
And one of those was we were out at a nightclub in Leeds. And I don't quite remember how the topic came up, but you said something about satellite tagging crocodiles. And
oh, there's a photo of that.
There is a photo of that.
With the Latin name.
Yeah, so I don't know how that came up, but Roby was talking about satellite tagging crocodiles. I got really excited. You're like, you know what satellite tagging is? And we had a whole moment. We were probably a bit tipsy and we bonded
in the club.
In this weird outdoor space in the club. And we were talking about satellite tagging crocodiles. So if that doesn't tell you we're nerds, I don't know what does.
And I believe they were saltwater crocodiles because I remember squealing when I think either you or I said saltwater crocodiles, and you said, ah, Crocodilus porosus. And I went, ah!
I think that was you showing the Latin name.
No, it was you. No, it was you. Because I remember it really clearly because I remember thinking, yeah, this one's good.
That's quite impressive. Maybe tipsy Emma remembers more Latin than sober Emma.
So don't tell me, is this actually a story about satellite tagging saltwater crocodiles?
It is, yes.
Ah, fantastic! Oh, that's brilliant. Tell me more.
So I saw this and I thought I have to include this because it's it buns Roby and brilliant. I from the very beginning. So it's an exciting story that came out at the end of April this year about Bangladesh using satellite transmitters on saltwater crocodiles.
Ooh, love that.
So it was, I guess, researchers from the forest department in Bangladesh. They were putting transmitters on two saltwater crocodiles. And I think this is the first time that it's been done in Asia.
Okay,
so that was kind of the big wow of the story of why it was so exciting. And so once they satellite tagged them, they then released them in the Sundarbans waters. So,
oh, cool. Another place we need to go together.
Absolutely. Yeah. So do you want to explain what satellite tagging is to give people an idea of what we're looking at here?
Well, it's quite a broad, concept. So essentially you tag an animal. And you use if a leopard, you can collar it. For birds, you have these little tiny transmitters which sit on their back. You've got some transmitters you can put under the skin. For sharks, it's a little kind of spike that gets put through the fin. I think it's the same with whales. There's a whole range of different ways you can do it. Some obviously more invasive than others. And obviously, you know, you'd use certain types for certain animals. You know, match the ecology to the tag, and you've also got to weigh the goal of the project with the amount of invasive handling you want to do of the animal. And so, for cats, which is what I've only worked on collar data for, there's kind of two types: VHF and GPS. VHF is you watch the old documentaries and they have to drive out with an antenna and pinpoint the location. GPS is it pings up to a satellite and you can look at it on your phone. It gives you a real-time location. So I imagine if they're doing satellite tagging on crocs, it'll be GPS. I imagine.
What they look like is these kind of, tags on the back of their head, kind of on their neck, with a tiny little antenna pointing up. And it looks like it's held in with, obviously, some kind of very strong glue, because we're talking about saltwater crocodiles here. So I think, they're in the early stages of testing how this will work and how it will pan out in saltwater crocs. But I think what they really want to use it for is just to understand their movement, their habitat range, their lifespan in these Sundarbans mangroves, where you might not normally get an insight into how they're living all of those stages and aspects of their life. So I think the idea is once they know more about their home range and how they're behaving, then they'll start to think how they could use that data in other ways to further the conservation movement of these crocs. So it's very much in the pilot stages. So it'd be exciting to see what kind of data they're receiving from the satellites.
Yeah. And as I understand, I think saltwater crocodiles are somewhat endangered in Bangladesh. They certainly are in India, in that part, same part of the world, at the Bay of Bengal. So that's really cool. And I mean, the real strength of collar data, or GPS data, I should say, is that you get real-time location. You know, so if you're trying to track an animal, you have to drive out every day with a radio transmitter to try and pinpoint its location, you are biasing your results. Because you're only picking up the animal when you find it.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, the data is usable, but it's biased. Whereas GPS data is fairly unbiased.
And it should be. So that's really exciting. Yeah, it should be really helpful as well, because like you mentioned, they are threatened, so they're labelled as critically endangered in Bangladesh. I think they counted, and this was in 2015, but there was a small population that they counted of about 100 to 150 individuals in these Sundarbans mangroves.
Wow.
And I think in Bangladesh, this will apply to other areas as well, but largely they were kind of exploited in the 1970s because of their skins. And that kind of predation and persecution pressures. They are now a protected species in Bangladesh, but they continue to face all sorts of anthropogenic threats. Still hunting and poaching remain prevalent, but also kind of more people moving into the Sundarbans as an area for their livelihood. So fishing, timber, you know, the usual, building up more settlements in areas that used to be maybe mangroves. It's really exciting that this is a start anyway to try and monitor what these crocs are doing.
Fantastic. Oh, that's good. I like that story. Nice. Well done. Yes, well done.
Well
good
done.
Story.
Okay,
nice.
Thank you.
Positive news.
I'm glad you like it. And a little throwback to our first year baby Emma and Roby who bonded in a nightclub.
Oh, we were babies like that back then. We were so innocent. So naive about the ways of the world. Brilliant. I love that. Well, I also have a positive global conservation story.
Where is yours based in the world?
Okay, again, weirdly, we've unknowingly coordinated in Myanmar. So not that far away.
This is so... what are the chances of this?
So our species of the week were all South America, uncoordinated. Our local conservation stories were small mammals, uncoordinated. And then our globals are both in Southeast Asia, uncoordinated.
What can we say? We're just in sync.
We're just in sync. So I'm going to talk about the Skywalker Gibbons.
Oh,
and what a great name that is.
That is
Skywalker
brilliant.
Gibbons. So first of all, and this, okay, so while I was researching this story today, this completely blew my mind. And I really had no idea about this. Guess how many species of gibbon there are?
Oh, I don't know if I'm going to go too low or too high here. I'm going to
say... So this blew my mind.
I don't know. 50.
20?
20.
20? Where were all these gibbons? Where have they come from? I thought there were like three.
Where are I? Yeah, I went really high because I was like, it's going to be ridiculous. But actually thinking about it, I can only probably name like one species of gibbon. So I don't know where the others are coming from.
I just, where did all these gibbons go? I mean, I was, you know, sort of researching Skywalker gibbons, came across the fact that there were 20 gibbons. And I was like, what the fuck? No one told me this. A little background on gibbons. So you have the apes. We're apes. You're apes. Everyone listening to this is an ape, unless your dog is also listening to your podcast. Not an ape. That would be a canid. I don't know. They could have it on loudspeaker. So apes. Strictly speaking, apes is hominoidia. It's a clade of primates. Within hominoidia, I know I said I wasn't going to do taxonomy, but I feel I have to for this. It just makes sense.
If
you want to understand gibbons, you need to understand. So hominoidia is apes, yeah? Within hominoidia, you've got two families. I'm sorry. Okay. Within hominoidia, you have two families. Emma's broken. I can just see your microphone wobbling. Okay, now I'm going to do it.
Okay, no.
Okay.
Give us the taxonomy.
Okay, hominoidia is apes. Within hominoidia, you've got two families. Hominidae, which is the rather anthropogenically called great apes, which is orangutans, gorillas, chimps, bonobos, and us. The second family is the rather insultingly named lesser apes, which is just the gibbons. But there are 20 of them, which is insane.
I don't think they're lesser, though.
I don't think they're lesser either. Four genera of gibbons: Hulock, which has three species, Hylobates, which has nine species, Symphalangus, which has one, Nomascus, which has seven. Where did all these gibbons come from? Sorry, I'm getting very excited about these gibbons, but it's completely blown my mind. I'm not really a primate person, so I feel I'm weak on my primates, so I think this is why it's surprising me.
So where do these Skywalker gibbons fit?
Well, they're Hulok Jianxing, and I apologise if I mucked up that name. So it's one of the three Hulok gibbons, only described in 2017, so it's already, it's quite a new animal. Obviously it's not new, the animal isn't new, but you know what I mean. And yes, it is named after Luke Skywalker, which is fucking epic.
How are they allowed to do that?
Even more epic, it's because it's a pun, and it's a pun in two different languages. So it's named the Luke Skywalker gibbon, but the specific name, Tianxing, is the transliteration of the Chinese terms for heaven and movement. Skywalker. And it refers officially to the brachiating movement of the gibbons, you know, where they swing on their arms between the trees. So it's a pun in two languages on two levels.
That is brilliant.
That is pretty brilliant.
So what? How were they allowed to name it after Luke Skywalker? Was it the fact of how they move? Kind of, you were saying it relates to their movement, or was someone just a Star Wars fan?
I think someone was a Star Wars fan, and then managed to figure out that if you combine Tian and Xing, you get heaven movement from the literal Chinese, and made that the specific name, and relating to their movement and to Skywalker. I mean, I think that's brilliant. So previously this species was only known from southeastern China around the Mount Gaoligong mountain region. Again, apologies if I didn't get that name right. But a new expedition from researchers from Flora and Fauna and the Nature Conservation Society has confirmed the species for the first time in the forests of northeastern Myanmar. Mm. With the researchers using acoustic monitoring to confirm that they were there. And I'm now going to play you the calls of the Skywalker gibbon. Okay, you ready? I'm going to turn it up. I mean, I hope I don't deafen people.
I can't hear it.
Can you not hear it?
No, I just heard silence. Well, so I was like, am I meant to?
Okay, well, I held it up to the microphone. So anyway, that was the call of the Skywalker gibbon.
I would say wow, but I didn't hear it, so.
We will play, we'll make sure that the podcast listeners can hear it. And they were able to identify 44 groups of Skywalker Huloks, which is the largest known population of the species. The Chinese population consists of fewer than 200 individuals, so this is a very important discovery and a lovely bit of global good news to end this podcast on, I feel.
That is very lovely, and I think particularly to listeners who will have been able to hear the call, that will have been a lovely way to kind of to hear and picture what these amazing species sound like, because I think they're one of the species that really captivates me in nature documentaries, just the sounds and their movement. It just, you can tell how they're really meant to be in the trees, just everything about them is meant for that arboreal lifestyle, and then you realize how crap we are in terms of having left the trees and have lost all of those kind of abilities to navigate the arboreal landscape.
Yes, I'm not convinced coming down from the trees was a good idea.
No, you say that, you know, a lot.
Now we have taxes.
When you say taxis.
Taxes.
Oh, taxes, they're even worse, yeah.
And data loss. And you know, McDonald's. So I'm back up to the trees for me, frankly. And on that note, thank you very much for listening to this very, very rambling episode of Zoology Ramblings with, one can only hope, your favourite zoologist conservationist duo, the wonderful Emma Hodson and myself.
So, as ever, if you want to stay on top of what we're doing, we're both very sporadic posters, but we are on Instagram under Emma Hodson Wildlife and Roby Watkinson Wildlife. So you can stay on top of what we're doing there, and feel free to reach out. Keep suggesting animals, and I can't promise we'll get to all of them. But
so thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next time.
See you next time.
Bye.